Hello and welcome to the Skilding podcast. We believe that true deep learning occurs when three things happen. You must 1, understand, 2, remember, and 3, deliberately practice your newly acquired knowledge. This podcast covers the first part, understand. Complete this learning by getting the second and third part at skilding.com. So together, let's get the key takeaways from this book understood. Hello and welcome to the podcast with Graeme Owens. Graeme, who are you? What book are we doing? Tell us all about yourself.
Who am I? It's a good question. That's one of the big questions.
An existential question to start with, yeah.
It's an easy one to start off with. Thanks, yeah. Kevin. My name is Graeme Owens. I've spent the best part of the last decade actually working in the Middle East, but I spent the last 23 years or so working in L&D. In Ireland, Europe, and in the Middle East. Just recently returned back to Ireland there last August, so starting to put the foundations down for a little kind of a practice of my own, I suppose. So I do a lot of executive coaching. I do a lot of consultancy work with different companies and try to, you know, help out where I can in terms of L&D strategies and L&D programs that companies are, you know, need help with. It's been very enjoyable so far, to be honest. But, with the new year, I suppose a fresh impetus now. So I'm going to hopefully launch a new business.
Excellent. Cool.
And that's the plan. I
have two questions. Why did you go to the Middle East and why did you come back?
That's a good question. I went to the Middle East. Initially, I was working with an engineering company here, and they had offices out there, and they approached me about going out to head up the HR department for the Gulf region. It's a great opportunity. It was good timing. My wife and I had just been married, and we were up for a bit of an adventure.
Yeah.
We had kids at the time, so, you know, we had little, I suppose, to lose, the right phrase. So we thought, well, give it a go. And I'd been over there, I'd visited a few times, so I always enjoyed it when I went there. Of course, living there is different, but we went over and settled remarkably quickly. It was a busy job. There was a lot of travel regionally. And we had, 4,000 people in the region working on different projects, construction projects. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of time to think about it. So, before you knew it, a couple of years had passed, and it was kind of a time then we had to make a decision to come back or not. And at that stage, my wife and I had both kind of settled into the lifestyle, I suppose, there. And we didn't have kids either at that point. So we said, well, let's give it a while longer. So 2 years turned into 2 more years and 2 more years and 2 more years and 3 kids later. we came to a point, I suppose, maybe it's an anniversary thing. I think there's something about when you reach a milestone in anything, you start to think about, the bigger question. So we had our kids and they were of a nice age, and we had, before we left, bought a piece of property before building a house on. So we had done that, and that was a big drawback for us. So, cut a long story short, the timing was right, Kevin. We felt we had a great life there, and we learned a lot. But at the same time, the old cliche, friends, the culture, drew us back to Ireland. There isn't. And I'd never regret the decision to go. It was a great decision. We had a great time. But at the same time, we was right to come back as well. So, every chapter.
Yeah.
And every chapter ends.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, I think I've probably said this on the podcast before, but where I live in North Dublin, I was born and raised here, and I have no desire to leave. It's so weird. Like when I hear about, I'm always fascinated when people just kind of go on that adventure, like to another country, and go and live somewhere else. It just doesn't. It's not for me at all. Like it's so weird. I don't know what it is.
It wasn't something I planned either. To be honest, I had traveled with the job because it was a group role I had with this company, and so I'd spent time in Russia and UK, Poland, and so on, and the Middle East. So it was, I had tasted a flavour of that kind of lifestyle. But when the opportunity came up, it just was intriguing. And it was a good opportunity financially, it was a good opportunity for career. And I suppose fundamentally, the government was open to it, but it should not have been. It has to be a big decision.
Your sound is gone a little bit there. Are you something I could.
Maybe it's. Is it any better or worse?
That's better now, yeah.
Okay. It was just the right timing. It was that the planets lined up, Kevin, and. But then also, as I said, it was the right time to go back to. I think if the kids had gotten any older, we might have struggled to unearth them from.
Well, that's it. Like I've three kids as well, and they're all. Well, the youngest is going to school next year, but it's funny, like once they start integrating and start playing sport and stuff and doing all that, you think, well, Jesus, you couldn't uproot them now. Like they're all their little friends and all, you know?
Yeah. They're very resilient, I have to say, though.
Oh, yeah.
Even ours, they came back. It was like, you know, a couple of weeks, it was all focused here then again.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about the Middle East or anything like that. Even they stay in touch with some of their friends and that, but they were very easy to integrate back in.
Yeah.
I think any later or any older would have been more challenging.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, I'll accept that as an answer as to why you went and why you came back.
Sorry.
No, that's good. That's I don't think I'll ever leave Rohini. Like it's a strange.
I think it's something that, you know, you never really know until somebody proposes it to you, and it's a terrible plan, and you can see it. We did give ourselves a parachute, so I went out for 3 months, and if I didn't like what I saw or didn't like the experience, I had the opportunity to come back. So it was a risk-free adventure.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Or, you know, but, you know, it's, you know, you go where life takes you. And I wouldn't regret it at all. It really made some great friendships, great business friendships, commercial friendships, but professional and everything. And, you know, it broadens your mind to a degree as well. You see different cultures, different, you know, obviously, Islamic religion. Very different cultures, very different values, very similar values as well, I have to say, you know, in terms of Irish values. It's good to have that reference point. And I, if anything, I'll be honest, it probably made me appreciate Ireland more.
Really?
You know, when you have a bit of distance, you get perspective, and you can see some of the better aspects of Irish life, as much as we all complain about things, you know, and that's an Irish culture. But when you go away, you can see a lot more of the positive.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I think I've heard that before as well. Yeah. Anyway, to business, the book.
Oh, yes.
What book are we doing? Talk to me.
Well, the book I chose was a book that I read. Now, I was preparing for this podcast. So I was trying to think, when did I read it? I think it was around 2002, 2003. It was published in 1997, so I was 25 years old. The book is called Tuesdays with Maury, written by Mitch Albom.
Yeah.
It's one of those books that a lot of people have read. Others have who haven't read it, I think, really enjoy it. It's a book about life lessons.
Yeah.
Different life lessons that this individual, Mitch Albom, recorded with his old college professor, Maury Schultz. Schwartz is the correct pronunciation. They go back. I'll give you the background to the book.
Yeah.
Mitch was a college student and had taken sociology lecture with this Professor Maury, and always enjoyed them, and they had built a nice friendship and bond, and I think Maury was his supervisor for his thesis and dissertation. So they spent a bit of time together talking about life and so on. I think they had a mutual respect and friendship, you know. Anyway, as life does, it takes them in different directions. Mitch graduates from college and goes off and becomes actually a sports journalist with the Detroit Free Press. And, you know, he's quite successful at that. And, you know, married and has kids and all this stuff. And about in his mid-30s, then he's flicking through the channels of the TV one night and comes across an interview that this old professor is having with his Ted Koppel, the old TV presenter, Nightline, I think it was.
Yeah.
And he stops and he's like, oh, that's him. And this interview was with Maury because he had been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, you know, that ALS.
ALS, yeah.
And they decided to do this series of interviews with him. And he was just talking to him about life. anyway, to cut a long story short, he prompted Mitch to get back in touch with his old professor, and there was delight. He was happy to hear from him and invited him to come and have a chat. So we had a chat with him, and they used to meet in college on a Tuesday, and they always had this phrase, you know, we're Tuesday people. There was this kind of in joke between the two of them. So Mitch came along and used to meet Maury in his house. He used to fly 700 miles or something to meet him. So it's a true story. It's a real story. And he used to meet him in his house on a Tuesday, and they would talk about anything and everything in terms of life. And then he structured that into a book and called it Tuesdays with Maury. So they met on a series of Tuesdays over the course of about 5 or 6 months while he was battling with this disease and sadly getting progressively worse in terms of physical health with the disease, although his mental health was even better than it had been. Yeah. So yeah, he structured these things into different Tuesdays, his experiences from that discussion, and recorded it. And it was, I hadn't read the book in, as I said, it was 20 years. Mm. But I still remember distinctly reading the book. And it was a book I couldn't put it down. I read it from cover to cover in one day.
I think I was the same. I remember reading it as well. I think my mum might have given me that book, and thinking like it was it's even a strange name. What is it? And then like you said, all these life lessons, like from somebody who's at the end of their life, is always a very powerful thing. I think when somebody is, on the way out.
It really intrigued me because I think, to be honest, I suppose 20 years ago, I would maybe be in search of some of the big questions myself.
Yeah.
What's it all about? What are we here to do? And, I've always been interested in those kinds of questions, I suppose, in terms of my work, personal development and professional development, people development. So those questions always kind of resonated with me. And to hear a perspective from someone who is literally facing the end of their life, imminently, I thought it was very powerful. At the time, it really sunk in with me. And again, talk about perspective earlier when you move away from something, but that perspective, I thought it was incredibly powerful.
Did you think, getting off the point here a bit, but did you think COVID did that for you, where you just kind of paused and went, what am I doing? Or what is it I'm trying to achieve? Or a lot of people I've spoken to seem to have that. I'll give you the story. My brother-in-law left his job as he was a marketing kind of creative kind of thing, and left that completely. And now he's a carer for people with disabilities. I've talked to him about that. And he said it was COVID to just what is the point in what I'm doing? He wasn't happy doing it, so he left.
I think there's a phrase that just came to my mind there when you said that, is that I think sometimes experiences, they don't change people, they reveal people.
Oh yeah,
it's a good one. And that, sometimes when you go through something traumatic, and COVID was traumatic for a lot of people, for very really traumatic, because they may have lost people to the disease, to the virus, but also I think they went through a completely unprecedented shift in how you live your life, and how you could live your life, because constraints that were put on people in terms of physical constraints, in terms of movement, but also then in terms of work, interaction with family, the risks around all of that, suddenly everything changed. That when you go through a fundamental life change like that, it can bring things that you may have suppressed or buried to the front, because now you suddenly have time, or you've shifted your perspective. And now you can see things more clearly. Maybe that's what happened with your
my brother-in-law. I think probably everyone's sick of talking about it, but I still feel like I'm processing COVID. What was that? That was a crazy couple of years where, that loss of control, or that that sense of the things you take for granted just were gone. My mom lives three minutes down the road from me, and couldn't call down to her. Those kind of things were strange.
And there's feelings that come with that too, the feeling of guilt that am I being selfish, because if I did go and visit her, who am I who am I doing it for? Am I doing it for her?
Yeah.
Or am I doing it for myself? And then, you know, am I putting her at risk? And then that's that feeling of guilt of potentially doing that. I was away at the time in COVID, so I think I didn't feel it as greatly as maybe my own siblings did, friends did, because we didn't have family around there anyway. So the only restrictions for us really were we couldn't see friends and we had to work from home. And for me, the working from home part was fine. You know, it was something I could do. There wasn't much I couldn't do from home.
And yeah.
Life went on, I wouldn't say exactly the same, but it went on, you know, say 50-60% the same for us. With the kids and that, you don't have a lot of spare time anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're out on a Friday night or on a Saturday night much anyway. So, you know, for us, it meant, I suppose, a quieter life, but if life was quiet enough anyway.
Yeah.
But I know my own parents, for example, you know, they're both in their 70s, and my sisters used to come and visit them, but they would bring them food and leave it on the window outside the kitchen.
Yeah.
They would open the window and take the food in. They would talk through the window at a distance. And even my sister's kids, you know, they're all young, it was hard on them because they couldn't talk to grandma and granddad and all that, you know. So I think when you had a closely knit family unit, like you have, that's where I think people found it much more cute.
Yeah.
For us, I said, we were a bit more detached from it.
And I guess that kind of brings us back then to the book. Give us some of the lessons then. How does the book start?
He starts by these, you know, these visits. I took a few notes just to talk through, but it talks about the first Tuesday. So, you know, the first Tuesday, they kind of just reintroduce each other and catch up, I guess, on where they have been, or where life has taken them, and they share their own experiences. But on the second Tuesday, they talk about love, and that's a powerful theme throughout the book. Is about Maury's thesis is that, you know, you don't really live until you learn to love. And he says, how love is the key to a fulfilled life, you know. And I think, you know, there's a lot we can take from that, you know, in terms of our own lives. But love is, you know, I say love is everything. It is really when it all strip everything away, you know. And he talks about the most important thing in life, he says, is to learn how to give out love and, more crucially, to let love in.
You and I listen to podcasts for many reasons. And listening to a podcast like this probably means that you're looking to get insights about human psychology, motivation, persuasion, things like that. Well, if you're here to learn, listening is not enough. In fact, that'll get you one third of the way there. You will understand this topic. That's the first part. But secondly, you need to remember the most actionable content when you need it. It's what we call remembering it at the moment of truth. And thirdly, you'll need to find opportunities to deliberately practice this content. This episode has a suite of learning tools that you can use to help you do this. Just go to skillding.com and search for the title of this episode. Back to the show. Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds a bit kind of wishy-washy, but it's something I've learned as I've got older, is that if you really have to love yourself first and kind of forgive yourself for things. And
exactly. And you're absolutely right. And that's one of the lessons in the sixth or seventh day. The one of the key lessons is, he says, you have to learn to forgive yourself and then forgive others.
Yeah.
Especially with, you know, when you're facing death, you know, people talk about forgiveness and the power of forgiveness, or forgiving yourself for, you know, mistakes you've made or things you've done.
It reminds me of that idea of forgiveness. Kind of, we're jumping all over the place again, but this is generally how it goes on these podcasts. It reminds me of, I remember studying a bit of neuro-linguistic programming before, right? So this, for anyone who doesn't know, it's like, it's kind of like a branch of psychology, but some people think it's bullshit, some people think it's the best thing ever, and it's probably somewhere in the middle. But it's this idea that the words you use can affect yourself and other people, and they have all these things called presuppositions, right? These kind of, I suppose, rules or whatever, something like that you'd call them. But there's one that always stuck with me when it came to this idea of forgiveness, or not even forgiveness, but also, but actually just understanding other people. And the presupposition is that everybody is doing the best that they can with the information that they have. So somebody like, and you could take that to the level of a murderer, right? This is why I used to think, like, somebody who kills somebody, they're trying to find inner peace. They have rage, they have whatever the thing is in them. They're doing the best that they can to get to that sense of inner peace. Now, obviously, it's a terrible way to do it, and whatever, I'm not condoning murder, but we take it down a few levels then, like somebody who is stressed to bits and they're your manager and work. Yeah. They're doing the best that they can with the information that they have. They've learned that this is how we handle difficult situations. We shout and roar and do whatever. And I always found that, I remember reading that and thinking, if you really see the world in that way, that everybody is doing the best that they can with the information that they have, you start to understand that everyone has different experiences, different values and beliefs, but everyone is really just trying to get to that level of inner peace, of just kind of calmness and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I always felt that idea of forgiveness, for forgiving myself, or kind of, you know, when you lose your shit with the kids or something, like, mm-hmm. that was so, it was uncalled for or something, or they didn't deserve that. And the guilt is unreal. But then like, you have to think, right, well, I have to just regroup and go again. And, or even something as simple as I should have worked out today and I didn't. I think, well, pony up and do it tomorrow. Like, you know, just forgive yourself.
You do. Yeah. And if you start from a place of that, I think it's easier to move forward with people. You know, you start from a place of they're doing the best that they can.
Yeah.
And if you really accept that, so assume the best as opposed to
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And take a more, I suppose, offensive mindset in terms of how those people are approaching it. We don't often do it. I mean, I think we're all guilty of assuming that, you know, if somebody hasn't delivered something for us in terms of work, let's say, that they're just somehow they're lazy, or they're not interested, or they're doing other stuff for other people, and that means that they're valuing their time and their tasks more highly than yours, and you feel offended by them. So, you know, I think it's a phrase. I remember a guy who the company used to work for, he's the CEO of the company, but his phrase is just, and when somebody disappointed, you know, and didn't deliver something that he would ask them to do, or, and I'm talking, you know, big things like winning contracts.
Mm.
You know, people would be losing their heads around him. He'd say, look, I'm sure he did the best that he could do.
Yeah.
The point he was making was, like, that's the extent. His view was, if this is what he's come back to me with, this is the best that he can do. Now, it may not be good enough for me or for the situation, but it's the best that he can do. But there's little point in getting angry with him and, you know, punishing him for doing the best that he could do. And you know, I think it saved him a lot of stress.
Yeah.
It kind of, he let things kind of wash over him because he took that mindset. It's the best the person can do. Therefore, okay, he's not the right person to do it. We need to find somebody else that can do this particular piece of work.
Okay. Yeah, it's like, there's another book we covered on the podcast called Never Split the Difference. I've mentioned this a good bit because there's one phrase he uses in this book. This guy was an FBI hostage negotiator, right? So this book's all about negotiation. But he talks about using something called tactical empathy. And the idea is that to see something from another person's point of view, and like you said about that CEO, that somebody presents, you know, the result of a project to him, and he's like, this is nonsense. Like, but you use that tactical empathy to go, well, this is what he's presented. This is the best that he can do. He's not the right person for the job. And you kind of have that, love is the right word, but it's also not, because it's not like that you're in love with your employee, but you have that kind of loving empathy for them. God, this is the best that they could do. And sometimes it could be, it's not good enough and you need to have a stern word. Sometimes it's an arm around the shoulder. Sometimes it's a kick up the arse, but
depends on what needs at the time, and all of those tactics are legitimate at different times.
Yeah,
I think they're all required. We've all had them and we've all benefited from them. I know I have.
Yeah.
But one thing I do remember from him was that he seemed to be able to make decisions to move on very quickly.
Yeah,
he didn't labor the disappointment, and he didn't, you know, talk about, well, what can we do to make this person. He was like, okay, that's the best that they can do, therefore. And he was very quick to kind of, okay, let's get somebody else in to work on this problem. Yeah. So he didn't waste time with the post-mortem of what happened. He was like, that's what you presented, that's it. Okay, then that's not good enough for what we need. Therefore, I need to find somebody else. And so it streamlined, I think, his actions as well. very quickly. You know?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot to be said for, and I think I've been in these meetings before where something goes sideways, and whoever the leader is, whoever's in charge, spends the whole meeting looking backwards as to why this happened. Like, just draw a line under it. It happened. It's done.
Yeah.
We can have a post-mortem afterwards, but if we're on the clock here and there's a deadline, then...
Well, even if there's not, I mean, it doesn't really serve much of a purpose to navigate as to what happened,
yeah,
because you can't go back in time. So to make the best use of the time, you need to look forward and I suppose we take a pragmatic approach as to how do we fix this or how do we change it? What do we do now that we are in this situation? And I think that's true of life as well.
Yeah.
You know, so much of you can spend, you know, an inordinate amount of time looking back or indeed looking forward. And one of the lessons in the book as well, going back to it, is about being present in the here and now, you know, and how, I guess I think it's the third Tuesday they talk about how life is structured, or society is structured to distract us.
Yeah.
From the being present in where we are. And I don't think that's been ever more real than nowadays, where we have so many ways in which we're distracted.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, you have to bring in laws that, you know, stop people from doing certain things because it's dangerous, like using a mobile phone while driving. You think that would be intuitive, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know, people are that easily distracted by things that it's actually dangerous. So, and that was one of the other lessons that they took away from, that they documented in this book, is about having to have a fulfilled life, you have to be present in your life.
Yeah.
And then one of the phrases that I'm trying to remember, I wrote it down here, is that, it's the two of them talk about how the culture we live in is often causes us to live in a state of detachment and what it means to be fully present. I think that's ever more true than right now, and it's something that when you practice it, you know, I think it's very powerful. I've done a little bit of it in my own life and try to use meditation to just bring everything right down, you know, into the here and now, focus on something as benign and mundane as breathing.
Yeah.
And when you do that, it's amazing how much clarity you get. You know, and there's a book I read before, and you may have covered it on the podcast, Kevin, is The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle.
I haven't, and I have it on my
it's
on my shelf there, but I haven't read it. I started and never finished, I think, but yeah, that was another good one. Yeah.
It's an amazing book. It's one of those timeless books. You could pick it up now and in 10 years and it makes just as much sense. But, you know, his essential thesis on that is, look, the past has already happened and there's nothing you can do about it. And there's no effect you can have on it. The future hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
Therefore, you have absolutely no effect on it either. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. The only thing you actually have control over and the only thing you can affect is right now.
Yeah.
So why bother, not just worrying about it, but why bother distracting yourself or pushing your attention to the past or the future, when really all you have is this momentary beating?
I remember reading something that it could have been in that book, it might have been somewhere else, but I remember telling my sister, who's older than me, that depression is when you're living in the past and anxiety is when you're living in the future. Is that from that book?
It's true. When you're obsessed with the past, yourself to the future, it's anxiety.
Yeah.
Where peace lies is now.
Yeah, just, and it's so weird, like when you actually, because I do some meditation as well, and a lot of it is about just being in the moment. Like, and if you think about, you know, say for example my business or my podcast or whatever, you kind of have ideas about where it's going to go and what's you have this vision of where you want to bring it to and all the people I want to teach and help and all that, but I'm not there yet. And it's like, it's almost like I've often felt like I'm trying to sprint with a parachute on my back. Like that I just, you know, like when you're trying to run in a dream and you just can't get going. That's what it feels like sometimes.
It's really clustered, yeah.
Yeah. But when I bring it back to the moment, going, well, everything's fine now. Like, you know, we're motoring. Like, everything is grand, like, really.
Like, what you're worrying about, I'd say, I think the statistics are something like 80% of what we worry about never.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
So if 80% of stuff that's concerning it doesn't happen, the question you have to ask yourself is, can I cope with the 20%?
That does, yeah. And it'd be the 20% that does happen would be something you haven't even thought about.
And look, there was a thing I read before. It was like, the phrase that always hit me was, real problems in life show up on a random Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
There aren't the things you see coming, it's the things you don't see.
Exactly, yeah.
And they blindside you. And, you know, that comes to loss of friends, family, you know.
COVID.
Stuff like that, yeah. Stuff you have never seen coming. That's the stuff that really rocks you.
Yeah.
Because stuff that you worry about, of course, you're mentally preparing for.
Yeah.
You're looking up strategies and plans as to how to mitigate those negative things. But it's the stuff you haven't seen coming that hits you and knocks you for six.
Yeah.
And that's the really, you know, I guess that's the really strange thing about life is, you know, we spend all this energy, but really and truly we're not in control of it.
Like, yeah.
You know, we're in control of now, we're in control of how we feel now and how we respond to life, but we're not in control of much else.
Do you know what I read the other day? This is a random quote, but you know Michael J. Fox, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's when he was 29. I didn't realize he was that young when he was diagnosed, but he said something in an interview the other day that you think life is all like brick and concrete, but it's not. It's paper and feathers. I was like, that is it. Yeah. Hitting the nail on the head there. Like,
it is. And there's another thing. I know it's from a Bond movie, which is less than credible, right? But one of the phrases in that one that was Spectre, one of those movies. I love Bond, but there was one that's like, said you're a kite dancing in a hurricane.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And I remember thinking, God, isn't that true of all of us in life, really?
Yeah.
We're just floating around in the midst of a hurricane, thinking we're in control of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we're just not. And sheer luck and good fortune and maybe help along the way gets us through it. But and one of the phrases, actually, we'll come back to the book, actually, Kevin. One of the phrases I just remembered noting here and reading it there when we were talking was, the truth is, he said, one of his life lessons is, the truth is, once you learn how to die, you learn how to live.
Jesus, that's heavy.
That's heavy. And you start thinking about it. What he was saying was, you start to appreciate the very simplest of things. He used to watch a plant grow out of his window, and he used to watch the leaves taking shape, you know, changing colors and so on.
Mm.
Things that we don't notice when we're going through our lives, busy lives.
Yeah.
But when you are facing death in the face, you really start to focus on what it really means to be alive.
Yeah.
Notice these things and experience these things. And, you know, if any of us, God forbid, we were faced with that, you know, I think those lessons are what would really come to the fore for us. I remember another part of the book he talked about when you're dying, you know, you strip away, you start to learn to enjoy the process of dying.
Mm.
He felt he was quite lucky. And, you know, Mitch Albom was saying, how did you feel you're lucky? He said, so many people don't get to experience the process of dying.
Yeah.
They just do die. You know, they die suddenly. He said, I've had the chance. He had a living funeral, for example. But, you know, he was able to have all the closest and loved ones around him who were able to tell him all the things that they would have probably said to him at his funeral.
Yeah.
I remember he went to a friend's funeral and he said, what a pity he didn't get to hear all these wonderful things that people were saying about him.
Yeah.
So he decided to have a living funeral so he could hear it and he could reciprocate and tell people how he felt. And, you know, I thought that was a lovely way to look at it. And it put me in mind of a friend of mine who passed away from the same disease only last year. She was in school with me. And a lovely girl, full of life and full of beans. And, you know, but I remember her saying something similar where she said, look, at least I get the chance to tell people everything I want to tell them. I have no regrets. You know, I didn't die with any unsaid, messages that I wanted to give people. I could tell them everything. And he said the same thing. He said, I have that opportunity, which I'm very lucky to have. And so it was, again, everything he approached it from a very positive perspective, even though it was debilitating.
It is an interesting thing, like, because you think, God, it's so morbid to, you know, but none of us get out alive. We're all going out in a box, like, you know. It is mad.
And none of us get out of this alive.
No, yeah.
No, there's no winners in the graveyard.
No.
So yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's the thing, and that's why I suppose, you know, the power of being focused in the here and now, and appreciating what you have. And that practice of gratitude, I mean, that's, you know, what if you talk to, if you listen to any of the gurus that talk about gratitude, and even the you know, the power of now, and you know, the secret and all these books, I read most of them at this stage, but they all talk about, you know, an attitude of gratitude.
Yeah.
You know, the more you're grateful for what you have, the more good things show up, because you suddenly start to focus on the good, and more of the good turns up. And, you know, there's one phrase in my book that says, you know, what we think about comes about, or what we, you know, what we focus on happens.
Mm.
And so you can either focus on the negative, or you can focus on the positive.
And actually, as well, there's another. You can look at everything as, you know, even negative things that happen. Go, well, there's a lesson in it for you. Like whatever that thing is, like it could. It's up to you how you frame it.
Things happened in your life, and you look back now and think, what a blessing that was.
Do you know what it reminds me of this this woman called Debbie Millman, who was on the Tim Ferriss podcast years ago, and she is she's like a marketing executive or like a creative marketeer or something like that. She's a big deal, like, but she also teaches creative writing classes. And so she would say that if any of her students in the class had like writer's block, I can't think of something to write about, she'd give them ideas. Yeah. And one of the ideas would be to take out your keys, like your set of keys, and write a story about each of your keys. Well, that's a great thing. Like you have a bike key and a front door key, and like just, you know, set you off on all sorts of things. But another thing she said is to write about your darkest teacher. And she said your darkest teacher is something or some person that you experience that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. And now that you've been through it, it taught you something about yourself that you wouldn't swap for anything. And I remember thinking, and again, it kind of ties back into this idea of, you know, you get to decide what things mean. Like you get to frame things whatever way you want to frame them.
Absolutely, yeah. And you can ultimately, you can look at the most heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching experience of your life and constantly focus on the feelings around it, or you can focus on the lessons you learn from it. And we can't live life without those lessons. To be honest with you, I don't think you have a life worth living without those lessons.
Do you know everything we're talking about here? It's all quite high level and existential, if you like, but I sometimes think about these things right down on the level of your job and what you do for a living. That you could have fallen into whatever role you're in, and be kind of like bumbling along, if you like. But you can take all of these ideas of like, this is the show. This isn't a run through. This is the show. Like this, your life is it, and you can decide that. And I think this is again me being very wishy washy, but all that really matters is other people, regardless of whether you're working on an Excel sheet or, you know, strategy, whatever. Just solve interesting problems with good people, which I say on the podcast all the time. That's what anyone wants, is to solve interesting problems with good people, regardless of your role. And you can take all of these lessons of, you know, knowing somebody who died from ALS or, you know, whatever the tragedy is, and think, well, I can be present in my job right now and do good work because it'll help somebody else achieve what they want to achieve. Or I just wanted to kind of note that as much as we're talking in big life terms, it can be brought right down into the immediate. This email I'm going to send it with love. I'm going to send it with, you know, compassion and tactical empathy, and you know, if somebody's disappointed you or whatever, you can pull it right back to, well, it's just another person who's like didn't ask to be born, like he was just trying to get through life as well, you know.
It's a series of moments.
Yeah.
Every one of those moments is you've got decisions to make,
you know, as
to how you show up in your life and what you want to mean to other people.
Yeah.
You know, and it goes to, and if you think about work, I mean, how much time we spend of our lives in what we call work. It's a huge part of our life. So and I always thought, you know, I've been in human resources now over 20 years. And one of the things that would always astonishes me is I've moved in different industries and I've been in different countries. But the issues around people are by and large the same.
Mm.
You know, and every industry will tell you it's different. It's different in this industry because we do this, and other different because we're in the service industry.
It's just people.
It's just a collection. I mean, a business is a collection of people generating value.
Yeah.
And solving a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's how you generate, how you become valuable in terms of anything we do. If you don't solve a problem or create something of value to somebody else, you're not going to get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get paid for the, as somebody said, you know, when you do your degree, you think somebody's going to pay me because I have all this knowledge.
Yeah.
Required. Look at that, I've spent 4 years or five or whatever it might be studying for this thing, and somebody said to you, you know, people don't pay you for what you know, they pay you for what you can do with what you know.
Yeah, the application.
The application of it, the creation of value. And that value can mean anything. It can be a product, it can be a service, it can be an impact, it can be development of people, it can be recruiting of people, it can be putting out a podcast that helps people. That value is not how you define the value, it's how the person receiving it defines it as value. And that's the other thing that stops many people in their lives, I think, is that they feel, well, this isn't going to be, I don't see the value in this, therefore who else would see the value?
Yeah.
Well, it's not your job to see the value in this. It's your job to put it out there and let it be judged, let it be evaluated, and that value will be found if it's there. How many businesses like the Fortune 500 companies that didn't exist 10 years ago, you know? TikTok and Alibaba and, you know, Facebook and all these, like, that was an idea that somebody had to put it out there.
Yeah,
I think it might have value to somebody else. It did, and the value was created, and they're billion-dollar businesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, I mean, I think life is a series of decisions you make about what you're going to mean to somebody else and what value you might create for somebody else.
Yeah, there's a great quote about, you know, to get what you want in life, help as many people as you can get what they want in life, and that's how you'll get what you want.
Joy in life isn't about receiving, it's about giving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you know that when you get, I suppose, you know, we probably are a similar age, Kevin, in terms of, you know, you get to a point where you do realize that actually the joy that you get from something isn't your accomplishment of it, it's seeing somebody else accomplish it.
Yeah.
And you helping them do that.
Do you know what I do sometimes? This is going to sound like I'm showing off or something, but I'm going to say it. Sometimes when I'm in a coffee shop or Starbucks or somewhere, I'll pay for the coffee for the person either in front of me or behind me. And the look of confusion on their face is worth it. God, what? Sorry, do I know you? Like, no, don't know you. I'm not looking for nothing.
Pay it forward.
Yeah. And I just, there was this place I used to go to in Balls Bridge when I worked over that way. And there's a tiny little kiosk right near the hotel. I can't remember the name of the hotel, but when you come out of Lansdowne Station, it's a tiny little kiosk. Used to be I think it's gone now. I don't know what happened to it, but I used
the hotel all gone from there, never mind it.
Yeah, it's true. But I used to say to the guy I'd get the coffee from, I'd charge me for two, and the next person who asks for an Americano, mm-hmm. tell them some randomer paid for it. And I used to get a chuckle out of it, like every morning, just kind of paying for two coffees, like.
But it's the thing of, you know, it's true. It's you're putting something out there. You don't know the effect it had. That could have been the world of somebody. It could mean nothing to somebody.
Yeah,
they might think
exactly. Yeah.
Well, at the same time, you're putting something out there, as you said, you're sending it with love. You're sending it with gratitude for what you have. And I guess even that act in itself, Kevin, probably focuses you on how lucky you are to be able to afford it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what you're focusing on, as opposed to what you're doing for somebody else. You're saying, well, it brings you back to the gratitude you have for your ability to do that, you know, and you start thinking about, well, aren't I lucky that I'm able to? Aren't I lucky I have a job? I'm, you know, able to enjoy a coffee. I've got the use of my legs.
Yeah.
You know,
all that,
you know, everything that you know, we hold here. And I think one of the things from that book as well is when you strip away all of the noise, say the clutter we surround ourselves with in life, it really comes back to very, very, very basic fundamentals of human connection, giving and receiving love, forgiving people, forgiving yourself, and looking for, seeking out connection with others, because we're social beings,
mm-hmm.
we're You know, we're social creatures, and we achieve our best achievements, I believe, in life when we do connect together. And the unfortunate thing I see it, and I know ever more prevalent in this society, is the disconnection that is existing now between people. Where you can, and you see it with Meta, the metaverse, where you can have a virtual life.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't see.
I don't get it.
What's so appealing about virtually knowing people when you could really know people?
Yeah.
And experience that and have that. I guess it has an appeal, I suppose, for people, but I just think it's another way of disconnecting people.
Yeah, I think Zuckerberg has made a strange bet there on that metaverse. He's kind of shoehorning it in there, like, and nobody's really asking for it.
I think the idea of Facebook and all the social media, I'm not picking on Facebook now, but any social media platform, whilst to actually connect people, it's called social media.
Yeah.
So it just to bring people together. And the irony of it is that it's actually driving people apart, because they're doing it in isolation, although they feel a social connection, maybe, but it's a virtual social connection. And they're sacrificing physical social connection for virtual.
Yeah.
And I think, in my opinion anyway, there's no comparison between the two. You know, it's that interaction with people is what makes life worth living.
Yeah. Solving interesting problems with good people.
It's a great, and you're spot on.
Yeah.
It's solving those problems with people. And that's always been, you know, my field of work and study, and I do a lot of work in coaching with the same thing, where people have, you know, clients I work with, they've lost a little element of where they are in the world, let's say, and they find themselves kind of adrift a little bit. They've got a job that, you know, successful to a degree, but they don't know how to bring it to the next level. And, you know, that's something that, you know, people struggle with at different times in their lives. Some do, some don't.
Mm.
But it is all about focusing on creating that value, that, you know, what you can offer the world, your unique, your USP.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever that might be.
Yeah.
What do you have to offer? And, you know, somebody also said to me one time, you know, it's not about doing it differently than everybody else. It's just doing it your way,
yeah,
the way you do it. And that's enough. You know, that's enough.
There's a book I've mentioned before in a podcast as well called Mastery by Robert Greene. I think I've read that book 7 or 8 times. It was just the right book at the right time for me, probably 10 years ago, if not more. And this book is all about, why is it that we still talk about Da Vinci and Mozart and all those people, you know, hundreds of years later? How did they become masters of their craft? Like, how did they do what they did? And he talks about, when you said USP there, that's what reminded me of it. Mm-hmm. Your USP, your unique selling point, for anyone who doesn't know, is there's something for you to master in life. And it's based on your knowledge, your experiences, and your interests.
Mm.
The three of them, there's a Venn diagram between the three of them, and in the middle is your thing, your niche, like the thing that you can master.
Yeah.
And then he talks about how you actually, you know, find an apprenticeship for yourself, and how you kind of, you know, eventually have to overtake your own master and, you know, break the rules, and that kind of thing. So it's an amazing book about, and that's kind of what's led me to this podcast, actually, and to doing what we're doing with the platform and all that. It's becoming more and more niche, and like, I think about that book a lot, Gomel. What's my knowledge, my experience, my interest? What do they add up to? What's the interesting problem that I can solve? That's kind of my thing. Give us another couple of lessons there from the book.
Sure. Yeah, I was just going to say, we'll see.
We keep getting off. I told you this would happen. Just keep going off on tangents. It's all part of the fun.
There's a lot of brilliant phrases or brilliant quotations in the book, and it's impossible to actually quote them all. But one of them was, and again, they're powerful, and kind of have to stop and think about them a little bit. But he said, "Death ends a life, not a relationship." And you just touched on it there, Da Vinci, these great masters. We're still talking about them. We still have a relationship.
Yeah,
they're long, long, long gone. And you know, so. And what that for me meant was that, you know, even beyond when I'm no longer here, when I'm, you know, long in dust, that relationship that I've built with people I love and people who love me that's what will endure.
Yeah, that should reverberate through the generations, hopefully.
But that's all that will endure.
Yeah.
And you know, I read something one time where somebody said, I can't remember the person, but in three generations or two generations, you'll be forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, of course, you've had that impact on people and they're telling your story through time.
There's this guy called Becker who wrote a book called The Denial of Death. I probably have talked about this before, but in this book he talks about the two people who are in you, essentially. One is the actual self, so you're, and I'm actually I've noticed it in my eldest daughter, and now my second daughter starts asking about death and coffins and what happens and are you just asleep and, you know, all these really practical questions about what death is. So when she's six now, so she is at a point where she's starting to understand that the physical body will decay and die. She's looking at people getting older and stuff. So this is what this guy talks about in his book, is that everyone realizes from an early age that the physical me and the physical you will die at some stage. But then he talks about the conceptual self, this idea of Greymon's, he existed in the world. And there's a chance that we can make that last for a long time.
Yeah.
And the way you do it, the way he says that a lot of people do it, is through what he calls immortality projects. So an immortality project is, you put your name in a building, you have lots of kids, whatever the thing is. So we all have these immortality projects, and you get to decide what your immortality project will be. Will it be a mastery of art? Will it be just being a good person, raising good kids? What will your immortality project be? And that's how you get your conceptual self to live on after the physical self dies.
But and this is the thing. I mean, this book is another demonstration. It was written 25 years ago.
Exactly.
The man passed away, and we're still talking about what his perceptions of life were.
Yeah.
And you know, they're as true today as they were 25 years ago, and they'll be as true in 25 more years' time, I believe, as they are today.
Yeah.
And some of the things are just immutable. Like they are real. And you know, the act of, and one of the things he talks about in the book is act of giving as a means to have a meaningful life. That you have to, as I said, you know, give love, but you have to let love in. You have to forgive yourself and forgive others. But this sense of, you know, ebb and flow of life, you know, you really have to go with that flow. And goes back to my, you know, the bond cord, but the hurricane. You know, it's like, you know, how do you, you don't sail a boat, you know, into the wind, you use the wind.
Yeah.
As a, you know, you go with it, and that's how you navigate life. But if you don't have that ability to, or the I would say the ability, but maybe not the ability is the wrong word, but if you don't have the wherewithal to realize that and do that, I think you're missing a big part of life.
Yeah, that's self-awareness. Yeah.
What's great about life, you know, what's wonderful about it. And how you can create those legacy immortality projects, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it funny too, when you mentioned it, something sprung to my mind, is like, you know, all the great industrialists of our time, you know, they all did that.
Yeah.
They're on Carnegie, you know, Rockefeller, they're on buildings, they're on universities. When it comes down to it, and you know, even look at the modern ones like Buffett and Gates, and these guys, they're giving away, they're going into philanthropy. Mm-hmm. Because they realize, you know, and always probably known it, but now they really see the power of it. The material will vanish.
Yeah.
What will be left is what you did with that material, and what you did with that, and how that is your immortality project. And they're pushing all of their money into those areas to help other people, because they realize that is actually what life is about. And if the sooner you realize that, I think the more fulfilled your life becomes.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to end this podcast, Graham. Tell everybody where they can find you if they want to get more information about you.
I'm available on LinkedIn if you look for Graham Owens on LinkedIn. My email is GrahamOwens35@gmail.com. The age I was when I created it.
So nice.
As creative as I am.
Yeah.
hopefully in next month we'll be launching our new website and business, the Development Clinic.
Excellent.
So maybe we'll have a chat about that at some 100%, stage.
100%, yeah, we will. All right, Graham, thanks for being on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Wonderful, Kevin. Thanks a million.
Hey, before you go, just a quick message about Skilding and what we're all about. We believe that true learning happens when you understand, remember, and deliberately practice your newly acquired knowledge. This podcast just covered the first part. You now understand the key takeaways from this book. To help you remember them, we will send you three interactive summaries that accompany this episode to empower you to remember the key takeaways at that moment of truth. To really embed the knowledge from this episode, you can use the dedicated and completely private digital portfolio to set a time and a date to go out into the big bad world and deliberately practice the key takeaways covered in this episode. For all this and for all of our podcast episodes, head over to skilding.com, that's skillding.com, and search for the title of this episode. Until next time.